what I'm trying to do is to lay out for the reader and a full amount of information to challenge him to have a challenge him to organize that information so that he neither takes up the positions of Bartleby, the narrator of the story, Babo, Captain Delano, all the Spanish guys, Venezuela, right? Because they're all like, they're all confused figures. And that takes away. You see, I'm always like, slightly interrupting, maybe about following my line of thought. You see what I'm getting at? Everybody? I mean, that's like challenging, for God's sake. Like, you know, I know it's a very large group and it's very difficult. What the combination of me going on and on, and like you sitting down and there, it's a bit awkward, but like, do shout out. I mean, everybody's like, we have these friendly terms, I hope. But it is rather a big group, I don't think. I think that's where one wants to start then, about this kind of thing. So, and then of course it immediately comes up, doesn't it? Both in the relationship of Captain Delano to that ship, particularly in his case, the white Spanish captain, and the relationship of the narrator of the story to Bartleby, the question of responsibility comes up, doesn't it? You see, Melville's challenging you to make decisions about how responsible is the narrator, or should the narrator be, or whatever, towards Bartleby, huh? Considering he's like a darn nuisance in that office, he's saying, no, he's getting his head towards the wall and the top. No. I mean, I felt kind of like sympathetic towards that narrator after a while. they must have been jolly awkward having there. I mean, I want to have students like this sometimes. I just like sit and, you know, and saying no, but like, silently all the time. Well, they do, you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of unpleasant. And in Captain Delano's case, I mean, you know, his cozy attitude towards the white, you remember, and it's sort of like, I think his image to black is Newfoundland dog, as far as I remember, at one point, you know? That's all like, they're okay, like, nice, cuddly animals at their best, at their worst, they're savage beasts, sort of, you know, this thing going on. But both stories then dramatize very strongly failures of responsibility, I think, you know, in that way. So, the materials in these stories are very strong. Captain Delano fails to receive the message from the Spanish nobleman and his crew, his white crew, huh? Because like, they're all signalling frantically within me. You see what I mean? Like, within a sort of strange structure, they can't say too much other than they have their French cut. But they're all signalling frantically. If you reread the story, it's terribly obvious, isn't it, when you reread it, that they've all been signalling frantically all the time, and that you, the reader, are picking it up, and that Delano isn't, which is kind of alarming. Very ambiguous. And endlessly exciting, I'm sure. I've read this story many times, and it always works. And Bartleby, like, the important thing here, talking messages and signalling, Bartleby emerges from a dead letter office, you know, which is another one of these, like, parodistic communication stories going on here. The fact that he begins in this dead letter office, remember, where all these letters go that don't have any recipients. So we're talking about this kind of failure to reach through the people, failure to recognize the messages. And like Bartleby fails to reach the narrator too, one would better say, as well as the narrator failing to reach him. It's a reciprocal thing. No, there's a big fox in here because it all comes from the narrator. The narrator is a rather bland person and does think, you know, that Jacob Astor, this millionaire, starry-eyed kind of hero. But watch it carefully, because Melville is not, by any means, it seems to me, making out that Bartleby is some kind of existential naysayer or something. I've read a lot of criticism of this, and it seems to me that there's a lot of things going on in this story besides that, which I want to get to. So, these breakdowns in sociality, to use a Melvillian word, are what we want to occur. And of course, then there's the whole business, to be more philosophic for me, it comes out very much in the Benita Serena story, of the relationship between appearance and reality. It sounds corny to even say it about Benita Cereno because it's so obvious that, like, the appearance certainly isn't the reality, and that is the whole point. But even more important is, like, well, how come Frank? How come Benita Cereno is in this condition in the first place, and how come he can't really communicate it through to this rather cozy Captain Darno? And just how come the situation in the Vault of the Office comes about this point? So I think that what one has to say then about both of these stories, to my mind, finally, is that in neither story is there a final single point of view truth. You see what I'm trying to say? There's a bit. Yeah, it's like a dramatization of various points of view. And the Bartleby thing is a bit tricky to see that, I do admit, but I'm trying to show you the evidence for this if you're not all that convinced about it, and I can imagine the ways in which you might not be. I'll try and show you this. But basically, let me say that I think the technique of these stories is a juxtaposition of points of view, so that you don't get a single one, you see. You've got Bartleby and the narrator. You even know Ginger Nuts, the guy in the office who has a lot of those points of view, too. And not to speak of Mr. Astor, but the in Bartleby, in Benita Cereno, you certainly have these three distinct things: the black slave point of view, the rebellious leader, and the aristocratic Spanish captain point of view. Remember what they're carrying on that ship, by the way, which will show you the American relevance. Remember what their basic is? What? No. Anybody? You know, they're bringing the image of Christopher Columbus to America. It's kind of weird. Which is not nasty, actually. So, like the Melville thing, a really miserably nasty game here. That's what's on the ship. So, this kind of thing there. These unknowing narrators is what's so fascinating, I think, in these stories. And the resolution of the story is deadlocked. I'm being kind of paradoxical. I mean, there obviously isn't a resolution, but the story is just like deadlocked, don't they? Like click at the end, you know what I mean? And you're left with it. But there's no real like Melville coming on like you know, the good guy in a play by Molière and saying, you know, and he was wrong and she was right, and like, and this one was well kind of like, have another go, and it's all that kind of story which lays it out. This is something else. This is a deadlock situation. Melville's very concerned with these. He's very concerned with setting up fiction structures which provide information which is very difficult to resolve into a single point of view called truth. No, just like that. So, have a look at that then, in novel generally. And of course, the thing that I was mentioning, for those of you who've been able to come to the lectures on Taipei, you'll see in both these stories, the thing that we were looking at, I mentioned in connection with novel himself and his stories, that is the themes of mutiny and insurrection and rebellion, the hero in both these stories. And you see that in Taipei, all these like escapes, and Melville himself taking part in those mutinies on those ships that I mentioned, and the theme was right through to Billy Budd. Of course, the whole point about Billy Budd is this boy, who is this innocent boy who is accused of a mutinous act. This idea of challenge to authority, the insurrectory situation everywhere in Melville. And he's on record for saying how much he admired the man that said no in thunder. Great phrase. Bartleby says no in a kind of squeak, which is just as powerful somehow and penetrating. That is, like I said, these are kind of constant themes in Melville that you want to watch. And clearly, if in fact, and you can imagine the importance for an American democratic feeling and culture, particularly given the, I don't want to go into this, but let me just mention it very, very just like point blank, given the the renewed feeling for egalitarian society under President Andrew Jackson, which occurs like in Melville's youth and onwards, you see, the 1840s and so on. You must remember that Melville is writing in a time where there had been a real spurt, like the second spurt in America establishing itself as a democratic nation, you see, after the revolutionary bang. And the Jackson period, I'm saying this very simplified, you might, but it's a very interesting fact. There was this egalitarian urge in the Jacksonian period. So that any suggestion of naysaying within a community was hit very hard. But again and again, American writers, right through to Hemingway, Faulkner, and Fitzgerald, have been concerned very much with those with figures that just say no in some way. And then someone will come on and say, if that's too much like it, someone will come on and say, like, they're anti-American, as was said of Hemingway by Archibald MacLeish and so on, you see. These naysayers, then, in an egalitarian society, in some kind of community, is what we're concerned with in Melville. And if one says that Bartleby is an exceptional man and Babbo, we've got this theme that we've seen in Poe and in Hawthorne of the exceptional person, you see. Not the kind of rake-hell exceptional person in Bartleby's case, but certainly a persistent naysayer within a sort of happy-go-lucky office structure. Is anybody want to like querying it? These are like generalizations. I'm taking it, you read the story, and so these stories, and you can like listen to somebody else's opinion besides your own. It seems to me that it figures fairly well, this kind of thing. I don't think the Benito, I think I spend more time on the Bartleby thing, but I'm going into these in lectures anyway in more detail later. But I wanted to put them with the Hawthorne materials. You see, imagine the Mikings of Major Molyneux very much as a naysaying situation, isn't it? You see, a challenge to the governor here, right? And in, what was it, Birthmark, you know, this like powerful scientist figure who's using this other human being. These things tend to be very much concerned in novel too, like Babbo using this white sea captain, you see, for his own challenging purposes of change. There's a great deal of this going on in the 19th century, you know, right through into major writers of the 20th, in the 20th and 30th, huh? Kind of thing in the States. I think this would be a place to say just how many major American writers, do make radical estimations of this kind, of the position of a writer or a scientist or some person of professional responsibility or exceptional ability somehow. Even the millionaire, of course, the man who makes an enormous amount of money in this situation, within a leveling egalitarian situation. Somehow there's a strong feeling that this man challenges what America was founded for. Okay, let's have just a very quick look at Benito Sereno's. I don't think it's a very, very complicated story. Again, like Taipei, it's based on fact. I won't go into it's based on reading and history, and it's like Melville's version, rewriting of it. Notice that Captain Delano comes from Massachusetts and speaks with Providence whenever he can, which shows you like a sort of Calvinistic Protestant backlog going on here. It's like the tail end, you see, of that kind of thing. And notice that he boards a ship called the San Dominic, and he himself lives on a ship called the Bachelor's Delight. Melville always plays games with ship's titles. What's this one? Like this, the Dominican Order was an order of black friars. And one of the clues to the story, and I'll go into this in the lecture, I think, well, because I don't think it's going to take some time, but one of the clues to the story is a book called The Cloister Life of Emperor Charles V, who went into a black cloister. He was the emperor of Spain and so on. And he goes into this cloister, and there's a lot of stuff about black monks in this thing, and plays on the Dominican order, and the ship's title you want to watch. So that Benito Cereno, I mean the title itself, like, he's on this falsely serene ship, is what's going on, do you see? Full of these strange black people who've taken over from a ship which has a white crew, which is named after black friars. I mean, this is like the black-white teasing structure. And it is complicated and takes time, but it's legitimate. He's not just playing silly word color games or something, you understand. He's trying to find ways of talking about the complex culture of power between black and white, between Spain and America, and between the blacks who are without the Christian religion attacking a ship which is in it and is named after part of it. You see? So that's justified. It sounds very complicated, but it's not in actual fact. But as I said, if you possibly allow me to go into that when we get to it later on, I think that'd be a better thing to do. So, Captain Delano moves off this ship called the Bachelor to Black, which is just a certain amount of inexperience and like happy-go-luckiness as well as everything else. And he's another one of Melville's like trusting sentimentalists. Which I suppose the narrator of Bartleby could be called as well, really. Not alert sufficiently to evil is the point, you see. This is a common figure in Melville, the man who isn't sufficiently alert. So the signals don't come off at him all the time.
He makes that specific one.
Pardon?
He makes that very specific in the beginning.
Melville.
Yeah, he says that he doesn't take anything as being evil.
Yes.
He prefers to find another way.
Right. I think this can be laid off too, John, along the lines of the fact that the tail end of Calvinism in New England, like Unitarianism, had relaxed very much, you know, this Puritan consciousness of evil in the world, of the Manichaean thing of evil against good as a continual battlefield in the world. And Melville is using this moment of relaxation, you know, of this kind of thing, as a way of beginning his story. You have to watch every move in a short story by Melville, because he's writing for good. I mean, he's not just writing for 5 minutes, you know. He's writing something. He writes because he actually has to get this clear. This man's an artist. He's not just some playboy writing. So we have this kind of incapability then, I think we'd better say. In the man, and as John said, it's right at the beginning. I think one of the ways you can, which is an explicit say, a thing here, during, you know, at the end there's a deposition about the trial. Do you remember at the end of the story that what happened to the trial? And part of the deposition is given, and one of it is that during the presence of Captain Amada Delano on board, some attempts were made by the sailors, and one by Hermena Gilda Gandix, to convey hints to him of the true state of affairs. But these attempts were ineffectual, owing to fear of incurring debt, and furthermore, owing to the devices which offered contradictions to the true state of affairs, as well as owing to the generosity and piety of Amerigo Delano, incapable of sounding such wickedness. Now, Melville is making a deliberate accusation of the generosity and piety of this captain, making him incapable of sounding out wickedness, you see? And that really is like a core of moral ambivalence, isn't it, in the story, do you see? There's a strong suggestion in the story that it may well be that generosity and piety may in fact make you morally unalert, such that you countenance wickedness. You see what the thing's going on here? If you aren't sufficiently, that is, it comes out in the deposition. Just a point there. You see what the Melville's playing at here? So, then, Benito Cereno then is forced to abdicate, and he's a broken man at the age of 29. He's an old guy, and retires to the monastery. Remember, this is a reenaction of the Emperor Charles V, who did exactly the same. Is the point, you see. So this is an enaction of an old world structure. This is an enaction of the great American theme of rebellion. But the teasing point Melville is getting is, this isn't just the old white world being challenged by the new white world. This is the old white world and the new white world being challenged by the black world. Huh? Amezo, Delano, and the Spaniards being challenged by the blacks, right? You see what I'm saying? That's the structure here. Okay, Benito Cereno was just overwhelmed because of the lack of his awareness. And Amezo Delano really gets away with it, just. But the situation is similar. So the ship then represents the court, taken over by the black friars and Dominicans, who are the operators of the Inquisition. And we're back with Poe's Inquisition bit again. Very cunning court, I suppose. And this is the image then of any power structure, any rebellious takeover thing going on. So one can remember that the Dominicans, after which the ship is named, were the operators of the Inquisition. And the court is taken over by the black friars. You see, Melville's making monstrous puns about black takeovers, which is like predictive, if you like, here, because you can see it's coming. You see? There's a thing going on here. Okay. And you remember the change that's made. The ship's motto has been changed to follow your leader, instead of follow me, which was Christ's injunction. This is a significant change. This kind of thing is what you want to watch then. And the figure of a white skeleton when the ship is taken over replaces the figurehead of Cristobal Colón, Christopher Columbus. So you have a ship as a revolutionary image taken over by the blacks, who replaced the image of Christopher Columbus with a white skeleton. And the thing, as I say, the plot begins to thicken. That's not quite the word, but like thin out, perhaps. So as you see it, what's going on, huh? So here's the slave ship. Of course, you were right with this now, but those people were saying the slaves. I was just being like sort of, well, stupidly cunning, I'm afraid. But I mean, in actual fact, these are slaves, of course. This is a slave ship moving westwards, and is overthrown by a black rebellion, which gets away with it by parodying Carr. I think perhaps one can say that Benito Cereno is a kind of, who's going, you remember, to be a viceroy, is representative of a hierarchy that the new world doesn't need, is one of the things going on inside the story, I take it. And Amezo Delano, in his innocence, compares that to the position of George III, governing New England. Of course, I mean, his innocence is that he's forgotten when he says about this that George III lost the colonies and his sanity. Which is like Melville's cunning bit here. This is a man you have to watch. As I say, Melville, he's making the references all he can, all the time. He wants to make the story an historical structure, you understand? And this is just a bit tricky, I do see. So here is Barbeau then saying, I would prefer not to. But within a context which is rather more complicated historically, huh? Do you think that Barbeau is saying, I prefer not to, as well as Bartleby, I mean, huh? Just that. And putting it into action. Not just sitting on his backside in a prison. Notice. And dying with his legs curled up in a womb shape. My Bartleby does. Which is a career kind of choice, huh? this is a man who really does say no in some, though, if you use Hawthorne. That was Melville's phrase about Hawthorne, as I mentioned just now. So, the overthrow of Spain and Columbus, and at the end of the story, remember right at the end, very interesting situation. Where, let's just remember the end here, where Don Benito Cereno is saying, after the whole thing is done, to Captain Delano, had I dropped the least hint, made the least advance towards an understanding between us, death, explosive death, yours and mine within the scene. True, true, cried Captain Delano, starting. You have saved my life, Don Benito, more than I at yours. Saved it too, against my knowledge and will. Nay, my friend, rejoined the Spaniard, courtesy even to the point of religion. God charmed your life, but you saved mine. To think of some things you did, those smilings and chattings, rash pointings and gesturings. For less than these, they slew my mate Ranus. But you had the Prince of Heaven's safe conduct through all ambuscades. And missing the irony of this, poor Delano says, yes, all is owing to Providence. And there it comes through. Yes, all is owing to Providence, I know, but the temper of my mind that morning was more than commonly pleasant. While the sight of so much suffering, more apparent than real, added to my good nature, compassion, and charity, happily interweaving the three. The man is a fool. Complete, but a very dangerous kind of fool, is Melville's point, you see. A man whose compassion, charity, and so on, his beneficent view of things, blinds him totally to the situation as it might be. He can't get the truth. And he calls that kind of thing providence. At the very end. So, and notice too, as for the black, whose brain, not body, had schemed and led the revolt with the plot, that is, this is a planned intellectual rebellion by this black slave. That is the image of, like, the planned rebellion. His slight frame, inadequate to that which it held, had at once yielded to the superior muscular strength of his captor in the boat. Seeing all was over, he uttered no sound and could not be forced to. His aspect seemed to say, since I cannot do deeds, I will not speak word. Putting irons in the hold, with the rest, he was carried to Lima. Remember that, those of you remember my lecture on the beginning of Taipei, I mentioned that on his way back to America, Melville called at Lima, do you remember? This is where he got lots of material from. During the passage, Don Benito did not visit him. Nor then, nor at any time after, would he look at him. Before the tribunal, he refused. When pressed by the judges, he fainted. On the testimony of the sailors alone rested the legal identity of Baba. This is very important, isn't it? That Don Benito will not identify this black leader. And one feels the answer that Melville is pointing, I think you agree, I think very pointed to the fact that he realizes at the end some degree of responsibility at least, you know? Otherwise, why didn't he denounce the man? Why didn't he say who it was? Why didn't he expose the identity? Shame, maybe guilt, for his own clumsiness. But also, one feels there's other motives here. And Melville doesn't state these, and I think the answer is I think the explicitness at this point would in fact destroy very much the dramatizations earlier in that shaving scene. Remember, John Babo is shaving him and all that. I think it's already been said what this relationship is. It's very intimate, very close, bodily in fact. This is what Melville wants to dramatize. On the testimony of the sailors alone arrested the legal identity of Babo. Then notice the body was burned to ashes, but for many days the head, that hive of subtlety, fixed on a pole in the plaza met unabashed the gaze of the whites, and across the plaza looked towards St. Bartholomew's Church, in whose vault stepped then as now the recovered bones of Aranda, and across the Rimac Bridge looked towards the monastery on Mount Agonia without, where 3 months after being dismissed by the court, Benito Cereno, born on his bier, did indeed follow his leader. So there's this fantastic final chord at the end of the dead head, the eyes in the dead head of the black, still looking towards the body of Benito Cereno. As if they have this like interlocked connection in death still, you see, which is the intimacy of two men on either side in the rebellion, where they just have to do damage to each other. Not that they're concerned then, always in these stories, that the insurrectory pair are a lot at the level of manhood, you know, this kind of statement is what's going on here. It's the kind of thing happening here, then. Very broadly, the kind of position. Again, I'm just like trying to indicate to you some of the things to look for. It's a marvelous story, but it's tricky. You have to watch things. I'm trying to give you information that might make it easier. You just say that I'm relying on an awful amount of information that I've picked up about the story, too. You mustn't think I worked all this out entirely myself, because it's you know, one least criticism of some kind. But I think that some of the ideas are straightforwardly my own, but some of the information is the kind of thing you read. You read notes to these traditions and so on, that kind of thing. But the Bartleby thing, I think one has to move in the Bartleby story in a slightly different way, in a more cautious way. I think for all its complexities and ins and out things and whatnot in Benito Cereno, it's a fairly clear story, finally, I think. I'm not so sure that Bartleby is. So I'm often, I mean, if I sound terribly glib, I'm sorry, I didn't intend to be about this story. Or anything else there, but the... I just don't want to like push the story so hard that you get the impression that I understand it completely. I'm still not sure I do. Let's look at the elements in this one then, in this particular story. There is this, first of all, it starts off with a very interesting idea, and that is this elderly Wall Street lawyer advertising for what is called in the story additional help. He gets it, as the irony. No, well, I play games like this one. And he wants it for his snug business, and all these phrases of coziness, additional help for the snug business. He wants, what's this language of breaking coziness, you'll see going on here, breaking of the lawyer's self-sufficiency is one side of it. I think you feel it in the tone, in the language. And a call is answered by Bartleby. And we are presented with the narrator in his own estimate. Like this. I am one of those unambitious lawyers who never address a jury or in any way draw down public applause, but in the cool tranquility of a snug retreat do a snug business among rich men's bonds and mortgages and title deeds. All who know me consider me an eminently safe man. It's this, isn't it? Snug, security, you know, this way. He's a parasite, like most lawyers, well, all lawyers. Maybe necessary parasites, but nevertheless, they're probably just about as parasitical as university lecturers, but I think that they're kind of more reprehensible. At least I think so. That's a dubious remark, too. However, the late John Jacob Astor, a personage little to give him to poetic enthusiasm, I'm going to say that again, but he was a famous millionaire. Notoriously taciturn, an interesting man in his early life, by the way, which Melville seems to miss. However, I had no hesitation in pronouncing my first grand point to be prudence, notice. My next method. This is it. Prudence, method, snug business, snug retreat, cool tranquility. You see the language. And above all, safe. If a lawyer isn't safe, it's useless. So, and he's recently received, and by golly, some of the critics make something of this one, the Master's Office, capital M. And they come up with all sorts of religious symbolism, which I have to refute. But you may if you want. He's been made a Master in Chancery, which is a purely technical term. Now, some of the critics say that in order to do the Master's work, he calls for help, and they go off into all sorts of stuff about the lawyer being God in his kingdom, and so on, which I've placed before you, because you may think the capitalization of the word master is important here, and you may think that this story has religious allegorical terms. But I put this to you because I must be very fair that there's a great deal of interpretation about this story along these lines. Certainly the basic terms are master, work, and help. This is what the triangulation is. And I do think the story is a joke about salvation.
Mm-hmm.
I take that very seriously. I think it's a joke about salvation by work and charity together. And I mean, when I say joke, you understand, I mean that very seriously. I don't think any joke that I know is any good isn't very serious indeed. So work, charity, love on the one hand, and master, work, and help on the other. It's the basic terminology. The nature then of succor for the needy. What happens when you take responsibility for this kind of person who is alone? And again, the religious boy takes a big kick out of the fact that it's on the third day that Bartleby answers his master's injunction to work and says, "I will prefer not to." I take it as being a straightforward refusal to work. And then he begins to withdraw into himself within the space of the office, notice. It's very strange. Notice how Bartleby obliterates outer space by looking at a wall through a window. It's just like he's deliberately narrowing already the area he wants to live in. Huh? Do you see what I mean? You won't even look out of the window that has a view. Is what I mean. You first look out of the window. Well, he doesn't look into the office even. It's like to a wall. And you know what it is in these big, in cities like in London, but certainly downtown New York and Wall Street. In the old part of New York, the streets are very narrow. And it's again, if you look out of a window down there, you look up against the wall. And this is, so it's not so difficult to do this, if you see what I mean. It's a choice to do it. So, but I can imagine, you know, like these skyscrapers all going up vertically in very narrow streets, which is very like downtown New York right now. And not the tall buildings in those days, of course, but still the streets are very, very narrow. And the old buildings down there are kind of five or six stories too. That's the kind of thing you want to think about. So then, gradually, this little area of work, this office, that is, it's very important. It is an office. It's a work area, you see. It's taken over by Bartleby. This under figure. So this stranger then moves in and, as it were, has a kind of power, which mocks the work, mocks the law, and he creates his own law within the law office. You see? He's different, that's all. He refuses work, stays put. He's independent, he's lonely. That's all. Now the narrator makes a move. Notice that Bartleby doesn't beyond that. That's all he does. So immediately everybody starts circling around him. You know, if someone like sits on their backside and says no, it's like, well, no, not like Gandhi used to, like pacifists do, you know, you just all sit there. And like, and some guy comes up trying to hit you off. It's what's called passive resistance and civil disobedience. It's an admirable technique because it usually forces someone else to work or act because you just aren't. It's very curious. I mean, if someone says to you, like, why aren't you working? That's action on their part, you see. Or what are you doing there? This is a very good technique. Then they divide into two kinds, John. the certain obviously like no. Okay, then he tries to befriend Bartleby is his action then. Let me find you the passage. Yeah, the passiveness of Bartleby sometimes irritated me. I felt strangely goaded on to encounter him in new opposition, to elicit some angry spark from him answerable to my own. But, indeed, I might as well have essayed to strike fire with my knuckles against a bit of Windsor soap. It's a marvellous image of total impotence, if you like. Like the fire and the soap. That's good, I think. I like that very much. But one afternoon, the evil impulse in me mastered me, and followed the following little scene ensued. And he like says, he helps him. When all those papers are copied, I will compare them with you, he says. Bartleby, I will prefer not to. How? Surely you do not mean to persist in that mulish vagary? No answer. No, he doesn't even say, I prefer not to say a word. And sits there. This is the technique, then. That is, that the advances of charity, the advances of hell, are refused. Absolutely. The traditional way is refused, isn't it? He just will not be helped. This is against the whole Protestant ethic, by the way. Let's make quite clear what we're talking about. The whole idea of faith, hope, and charity is being demolished here. Particularly the charity. So, and this is called, two pages later, unreasonable behavior. Sounds familiar. And then, later on, he asks them. The narrator goes to church and he calls in at the office. And there he is. And we get a lovely phrase for Bartleby on Sunday morning. His cadaverously gentlemanly nonchalance. Cadaverously gentlemanly nonchalance. Phrase for you. One of Melville's loaded things. Like this, like, you've got this Desi thing, you see. Achilles. You see, let me just leap ahead. I think you've read the story. I'm not spoiling it for you because I hope you read it. But there is, you see, once you start doing this thing, the line to suicide is pretty soon. You know, I mean, there comes a point when absolute passivity and reluctance to make communication with anybody, do you see what I mean? And looking at a wall becomes like deathly, huh? This kind of thing. Passive resistance is one thing. Absolutely passive, absolute resistance is another. You see, so Melville is introducing you to possibilities of masochistic structures of passive resistance. Do you see? This kind of thing, huh? Do you see what I'm trying to get at? It's kind of stuff. Sorry about that, John.
Oh.
It's kind of drafting. But he's sitting there, isn't he? I mean, and then at that point, he won't even answer. Yeah, but passive resistances are determined, aren't they? Passive resistors, I mean, they sit there. Yeah.
There's a certain amount of meaning.
There's
not meaning.
Oh, no, I absolutely agree. No, it's very difficult to talk about this because, as John Hall was suggesting, that passive resistors tend to invoke actions from other people. And therefore, a sort of action situation occurs in this way. But basically, they're not moving or speaking. And let's put it like this then, to be less confusing. Then, like he's narrowing down the space, you know, right, to that little bit of an office which he's in, right? He's narrowing down the area of action completely to a basic response to him not answering. It's a question of squeezing the area of exchange, isn't it? You know, to a very small area indeed in space and response. That's a bit better, huh? If what I mean. I take your point because he is obviously determined, yes. But he's not determined in a programmatic, extensive way. It's programmatic in, what's the opposite of extending? Condensing way. Do you see? Reducing in that way. I think that's the way to say it. But you're right, of course. He certainly is that way. Okay. What other phrases are there? Oh yes, the narrator feeling the narrator phrase, twinges of impotent rebellion. That's it. There's the Melvillian theme going on here. The twinges of impotent rebellion. This is something else what you were saying just now, sir. I think in the world of civil disobedience, this is called negative power. You know, it's like a paradox, but that's the name given to this kind of thing. So we have this, and then another phrase a few pages later, Bartleby's thing is called cadaverous triumph. And this word cadaverous comes up again, do you see? Melville writes very carefully. And then notice that earlier on, Wall Street is given on Sunday as deserted as Petra. Now Petra, you remember, was the ruined Roman city in Syria at the end of the Roman Empire. Stone city, you know, made Petra as the thing, isn't it? I don't know. Going a little too much, I hope. This, what's that? Rose Red City, half a dozen. Yeah. So, and then also we have later on, you've got Bartleby imaged as when he's really isolated, but he answered not a word. Like the last column of some ruined temple, he remained standing mute and solitary in the middle of the otherwise deserted room. You see the kind of material that Melville's trying to get into this now. A deserted city of Wall Street that's like a future Petra. It's already imitating the end of the thing. Do you see?
He's kind of deserted within the deserted environment.
Right. And he's like...
There are two levels.
Right. It's weird as if he was like tombed up in his own isolation in this Petra downtown New York.
But the room's deserted. He's also in London himself.
Right. Right. He's become like the single pillar in the temple. He's like, the strange idea too, that although it's ruined, he's still keeping it up, don't you think? Which is odd. The last column in some ruined temple. Or perhaps not, perhaps the ruins are too much. Yeah, maybe I'm making too much of that. So the narrator, the lawyer's feeling for Bartleby becomes quite more like fear and repulsion, doesn't it? You know, it shifts. The meanings and the feelings and the things shift. And we're told, and I find this very interesting language here, and I hope you do too, where he says, yes, they err who would assert that invariably this is owing to the inherent selfishness of the human heart. That is, this point at which the thought or sight of misery enlists our best affections. But in certain special cases, beyond that point, it does not. And now we're concerned with this area where this kind of case goes beyond ability to feel affection, ability to want to help, which is kind of darn irritating. They err who would assert that invariably this is owing to inherent selfishness of the human heart. It rather proceeds from a certain hopelessness of remedying excessive and organic ill. And this is a major theme in the novel, like I say later on. I hope you don't recognize this. It rather proceeds from a certain hopelessness of remedying excessive and organic ill. To a sensitive being, pity is not seldom pain. And when at last it is perceived that such pity cannot lead to effectual succour, common sense bids the soul be rid of it. this is an extreme situation, do you think, that now they're dealing with, right? Where this power situation begins to suggest ways in which the traditional structure of charitable help between people, and I don't mean charitable in like modernness, I mean in terms of love, breaks down. At what point, Melville is asking, does the desire to help your fellow human being break when he won't be? So that was a very important theme. Indeed, is it not? Clearly, it sits right at the centre of a great deal of problems of humanism. So, and then what I saw that morning persuaded me that the scrivener, that is Bartleby, was the victim of innate and incurable disorder. I might give alms to his body, but his body did not pain him. It was his soul that suffered, and his soul I could not reach. So then, there is this farcical situation, and it causes him to give up his Sunday morning church-going notice. You see, because it's, the suggestion here is that there's not much point, because that would be what he would be going to church to back, wouldn't it? You see. But he's reached a point which apparently he doesn't find he's being incredibly backed by his Sunday morning church going, and he stops going. Make no mistake about it, the narrator of this story is just as important as Bartleby. The changes he undergoes, you see, continually. It's what happens to this man. So don't think it's just about the title thing. So here we have this farcical situation. It is a farcical situation in some way. There's the normal, as it's called, invaded by the unreasonable, as it's called, this office community. And we have this man who has set himself up as a kind of little bit of privacy. And the word is used. Privacy. It's a very strange word when you think about it. It's like solitude or loneliness or... It's like an abstract virtue. It's like something you need, apparently. It's a very curious word, being private or privacy, when you think about it. It's more like an opposition word to things, isn't it? It doesn't really define positively. It defines something you don't want, that is, be crowded. Don't you think? I mean, it's a very strange word, privacy. Huh? It's curious, to me, at least. So, absolutely alone then in the universe is the phrase given here. Absolutely alone in the universe. A bit of wreck in mid-Atlantic is how he's described by the narrator. But now he decides that this intruder must be got rid of, and he gives B a bit of notice in strictly business jargon. Notice that business jargon, which is like suggesting that the lawyer doesn't want to be personally involved anymore. If hereafter in your new place of abode I can be of any service to you, do not fail to advise me by letter. It sounds just like a business letter, you see, is the point. And he slipped back into this protective device, which is like familiar to lawyers, because they always write like that so you don't have any hooks on. Goodbye, Bartleby, and fare you well. Then that's when he stands like a last column in some ruined temple and just stands there. You see. Impersonal, defensive, and so on. But then he says, I would prefer not to quit you. And there's a strange relationship implied with this, as if he was somehow with him. Which is like also infuriating to the lawyer, because of all the people that didn't with him, you see. It's this one. And the ironies begin to develop very carefully here. And then he retires, and notice the word that's given for what he retires into, the part of the office. It's called his hermitage. His hermitage. This is like a parody of the holy man going into his area, do you see? The hermit going into the thing, the little sainted fella. Going into his little area. He's starting to retire into his hermitage, phrase. Then the whole problem of what happens but to the commandment, love one another, crops up again. Because at this point the narrator remembers the tragedy of the unfortunate Adams and the still more unfortunate Coke in the solitary office of the latter, and how poor Coke, being dreadfully incensed by Adams and imprudently permitting himself to get wildly excited, was as unawares hurried into his fatal act, an act which certainly no man could possibly perform more than the act himself. That is, a previous occasion when when there was a pair like this, and the man in charge of the office got wildly excited, and a crime was committed, a tragedy. He thinks about the man who committed the act, the lawyer, as the hapless colt. And when this old Adam of resentment rose to me and tempted me concerning Bartleby, I grappled him and threw him. How? Why? Simply by recalling the divine injunction, a new commandment give I unto you, that you love one another. This is what, he says, saves him from repeating that disastrous situation here. So he decides then to try and act again charitably. Notice what he reads, by the way, at this point. He reads Jonathan Edwards on the will and Priestley on necessity. That is, he like tries to reinforce his feelings by well-known writers about moral action. I think Jonathan Edwards is a well-known 18th century American Puritan figure, you see. This is the point about it. You don't need to know about the books, you just want to know exactly what he's doing there. To give himself a bit more like nourishment for the act, he feels his energy being sapped, you see, by Bartleby at this stage. And so he's got to get some reinforcements. So, but this all fails, and you remember the next stage is he tries to move the space. I mean by that, as Bartleby has moved into this even smaller little space inside the space, which is a little tiny hermitage, you see, it's just this reductive thing we were talking about. And then said, I won't even quit you. The next stage is, okay, to move the office, which is like the papers, the shelves, and the bits, you see, to another space. You see, that's like the desperate stage. You take the situation and dump it somewhere else and leave the guy in the old situation. Which is like a sort of space game, if ever. So, in order to get rid of Bartleby then, he does that, and he plans to do it. Bartleby says nothing, and stays in, I quote, the naked room. That is the phrase. And again refuses money. He'd been offered money earlier, refuses money again. And he becomes, and we're like nearing the very end of it now, the motionless occupant of a naked room. What was the pillar thing, you see, at the beginning? The motionless occupant of a naked room. That motionlessness, you see, if you put that with the cadaverous bit and the pillar, you see what's happening, and the stone images, is just somehow he's moving to the area of the, let's just say, the not human for a minute. Huh? There's something quite inhuman, in fact, about his action by these standards and so on going on here. But nevertheless, he's still got this persistent, gutty sort of no thing to the situation he's moved in on. So it remains quite ambiguous here. The occupant there, the motionless occupant of the naked room, not the occupant, like, enforces the fact that he's got the power, doesn't it? You know, there's a sense that he's not just like there, he's occupying it. Which like reinforces the programming there. Okay? Then I tore myself from him, whom I had so longed to be rid of. It is a very strange like feeling of this liaison developing between the two, you see. It's very odd, very like, and as he says, strange to say, I tore myself from him, whom I had so longed to be rid of. So, then, the next stage is, and the religious interpreters of the story also make something of this one. He denies responsibility for Bartleby three times. You must understand, I'm not refuting this religious interpretation. What I want to say is that Melville plays this kind of game continually. In many, many, many of his stories, he will use the Christian myth as another myth. You must understand, you see? He uses it as a myth of death and resurrection of heroes within other death and resurrection of heroes myths, that kind of thing. And so that the story is available. it's up to you whether in fact you make it, in some of the interpreters do, into something more than that. And that is an allegory of Christianity, something that kind. Do you see what I mean? It's one thing using the structure of the death of a god, do you see what I mean, as a recurrent myth in the history of the world mythology. Something else if you make it a deliberate analog of a particular religion. Do you see what I mean? That's something else. Really, you must make your decision for yourself about that. So then, once again, it's very odd. The comedy takes over. That is when Bartleby is sitting on the banister, you remember. He says, now one of two things must take place. Either you must do something or something is done to you. Now what sort of business would you like to engage in? Would you like to re-engage in copying for someone? No, I would prefer not to make any change. Would you like a clerkship in the dry goods store? There's too much confinement about there. No, I would not like a clerkship, but I'm not particular. Too much confinement, I cry. Why you keep yourself confined all the time? I would prefer not to take a clerkship, he rejoined. I just to settle that little item at once. How would a bartender's business suit you? It's funny because, like Bar says, I'll stuck there behind the thing, you know, as they are. There's no trying at the eyesight in that, but obviously you feel the noise is a bit kind of testy and like being witty because you're getting mad. And Bartleby said, I would not like it at all, though, as I said before, I'm not particular. And then a nice ironical statement. His unwanted wordiness inspirited me. I'm like, it's very good because the tension is very nicely relaxed here, so that the thing stops being allegorical. Do you see what I mean? It becomes a very human thing again. Because it was in danger at that point. You probably noticed it getting quite rather abstracted. Huh? And Melville's like getting it back again here, which is very cunning. And like, well, now he's just a genius metaphor. So then after that little ironic drama, we get this. Bartleby saying, the lawyer says, how then would going as a companion to Europe to entertain some young gentleman with your conversation, how would that suit you? Not at all, he says, Bartleby. It doesn't strike me that there's anything definite about that. I like to be stationary, but I'm not particular. Then, Bartleby, said I, in the kindest tone I could assume under such exciting circumstances, will you go home with me now, not to my office, but to my dwelling, and remain there till we can conclude upon some convenient arrangement for you at our leisure? Come, let's start right away. And Bartleby says, no, at present I would prefer not to make any change at all. I answered nothing, but effectually dodging everyone by the suddenness and rapidity of my flight, rushed from the building, ran up Wall Street towards Broadway, and jumped into the first omnibus, was soon removed from pursuit. And he just gets out, but his conscience has still got him. Well, and then the end of the story is very quick. Bartleby is removed to the Tombs as a vagrant. The Tombs is like the still a prison in New York. What is it? 14th Street, 16th Street, somewhere up there. I have to go there. And a gloomy old place, as the name suggests. As I afterwards learned, the poor scrivener, when told that he must be conducted to the Tombs, offered not the slightest obstacle, but in his pale, unmoving way, silently acquiesced. Noticed. And this beautiful thing. Some of the compassionate and curious bystanders joined the party, and headed by one of the constables, arm in arm with Bartleby, the silent procession filed its way through all the noise and heat and joy of the roaring thoroughfares at noon. Noticed. There's a sense of like Bartleby then going through noise, heat, joy. That's a sense of activity, whatever one thinks about it, you see, isn't it? Of the extreme opposite of him. Noise, heat, joy, right? And he's like led through it, you see, to the Tombs. Okay, that's not a symbolic thing, but one must remember this is the actual name of the prison in that way. But it's, we have to hold the two things together there. Now then, this is a real problem. By the way, the irony, did you notice the irony? He takes them as a vagrant? And the one thing he doesn't do is like, what's the word? Travel, wander, that's it. So that's kind of nice. Okay, and he takes these halls of justice in this silent procession. Now, then the narrator, the lawyer, visits him, notice. Now, this visit, you want to watch very carefully, because it's the extreme end of the story. And what Melville does here is tricky. You remember, he sees Bartleby standing all alone in the quietest of the yards, his face toward the high wall. So even in the prison, notice, he's still looking at that wall, in an enclosed area. Again, like it's another enclosed area. Do you see what I'm saying? He's still like, it isn't enough for him to be enclosed that way. He's got to look at that wall right there close to him. While all around, from the narrow slits of the jail windows, I found him standing all alone in the quiet of the yard, his face towards a high wall, while all around, from the narrow slits of the jail windows, I thought I saw peering out upon him the eyes of murderers and thieves. Bartleby. And Bartleby says, I know you, he said, without looking round, and I want nothing to say to you. And again, he's completely rebuffed here. Now notice that this man is in, the lawyer hopes to get Bartleby into an almshouse as an alternative to this. He's trying to get him out of the prison. And there's no punishment for this prisoner then. And apparently it's what he wants. It's a positive thing. He's facing toward a high wall. But you must notice that he's peered at by the eyes of murderers and thieves. Now he's not a murderer and a thief. Notice he refused to talk to the lawyer, who gives him some money for his food. So there's still this like charitable action going on here. But Bartleby is not eating now. That is, he really has reached the suicidal stage, you see. There's a long, the story's a long move to the point where he stops eating even. Yeah. And then, this. The yard was entirely quiet. It was not accessible to the common prisoners. The surrounding walls of amazing thickness kept off all sounds behind them. The Egyptian character of the masonry weighed upon me with its gloom, but a soft imprisoned turf grew underfoot. The heart of the eternal pyramids, it seemed, wherein, by some strange magic, through the clefts, grass seed dropped by bird sprung. Strangely huddled at the base of the wall, his knees drawn up, lying on his side, his head touching the cold stone, I saw the wasted Bartleby, but nothing stirred. Yes? It's okay. That's the guy that comes and checks the lights turn. Then, notice this bit then. The round face of the grub man appeared upon me. Now, his dinner is ready. Won't he dine today either? Or does he live without dining? Lives without dining, said I, and closed the eyes. Hey, he's asleep, ain't he? With kings and counselors, murmured I. Now, the references here, you have to watch very carefully, because they are from the book of Job. And the quotations you want are from Job, verse 10, and verse 11. This is where Job is cursing the day he was born, remember. Because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid trouble from my eyes. And verse 11, why died I not from the womb? Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not perish at birth? Why did the knees receive me? And wherefore the breast that I should suck? I should have slept, then had I been at rest, with kings and counsellors of the earth, who built up waste places for themselves. This is the Job situation, then, of longing for a return to the womb condition of pre-birth. To refuse, to find rest. It's the existential situation which you find again and again, like, you know, it's better never to have been born than at the end of Oedipus of Colonus, this kind of thing. The passage that Yeats translated very famously. The kings and counselors of the earth. And that's why it's the narrator, the lawyer, who recognizes the situation that he recognizes, given a context. He remembers it may well be then the Job situation of having had enough of life. I should have slept, then I had been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who built up waste places for themselves. And that he obviously the intuition behind the thing too is that the narrator wondering whether in fact the word counselor being something that he's involved in as a lawyer, that he might not in fact be involved in these waste places himself. There's a very strange like equation then at the end, you see, of the suicidal desire of Bartleby to reduce his life to this condition in this particular way. And he doesn't say anything about it, but the lawyer tries to make a context for this strange action that's come into his life, this refusal of help, by remembering a context from his Christianity, which is obviously really strong in the story, isn't it? He's referring to itself, of the situation of a character within the Old Testament, at least, of someone who might resemble the Bartleby structure. So that's what you've got then finally at the end, this equation of refusal of sociality and love and the imprisoned situation. Bartleby ends up as like suicidally, totally introspective. He's silent, he's starving himself, he's curled up at the foot of a wall, you know, with his legs drawn up. It's the end of his free will, because he's chosen this. In a sense, you see? Very curious situation that Melville is describing, not explaining. It's the lawyer in the story who makes the implied explanation, you see, from Job, which may or may not be the truth, because there are several truths, as I said at the end here. Notice the Egyptian character of it, and the imprisoned turf, that is like something of imprisoned life inside the tomb, you see? The heart of the eternal. The idea of grass being life here. Now, Bartleby is refusing even that. He's not growing even inside the prison. This is the point that Melville is making here. And he returns to this weird fetal position, and the word is wasted. I saw the wasted Bartleby. And we're told he lives without dining. That he won't nourish himself on anything. And he ends up then as a kind of parody Egyptian god king in his tomb. You see, that's the point of the Egyptian masonry. You know, there's inside this time in the 19th century, maybe it was a bit more focusing than it would be now. But a great deal of unearthing of pyramids was going on, and like digging away at mummy things. And they found these people like, you know, and archaeology was a strong feature of 19th century stuff. And they were finding these people. Who were like masoned up, can you say?
Yeah.
Walled up in masonry in these tombs. So here, there's a kind of little parody Egyptian god king then, buried in his tomb pyramid, but not resurrecting. Notice, this is the point. This is an image of sterility, of deliberate, getting yourself to that stubborn point of absolute quietism. So that your life energy is drained. Huh? Within the context, though, and I must play it right back now, of Wall Street. Because this is where this is happening, and in New York, you see. And it starts in a lawyer's office. So you have the Wall Street, the law idea, the Christianity idea. This inaction is taking place within, then, the laws of Christianity, the laws of law, and the laws of capitalist money. It's a 19th century structure, right? This man has chosen to opt right out of it along these lines. And the lawyer recognizes that there is a tradition for this, and it is like not wanting to be born. So, but you have an equation of this. I'm not trying to overlap them, you understand. I think that the book of Job reference, and these other references to desire to return to death, must be just left like that at the end. I think what Melville's doing is trying to set up a causal conclusion, which is one of the possibilities of absolute sterility and despair within a Wall Street structure, do you see? Just that. That it might, in fact, there might, in fact, be Bartlebys who end up like that. And if you, and also the idea, if you press hard enough to say no in that society, there comes a point where the charitable structure does break and you bring the sterility upon yourself. There's a whole lot of things going on. I don't want to simplify this, because I think it's quite magnificent. But notice the final reference at the end to the dead letter office there. And notice that the lawyer is... He's not made of terribly much awful imagination, but at least he's not hard. He tries to find out about Bartleby, and we're told he was a subordinate clerk in his dead letter office in Washington. And this kind of hopelessness seems to be a moment in the story, if one reads it poetically, which instigated him along the lines of this kind of despairing sterility. On errands of life, these letters speed to death. And there's the strong suggestion that this is a possibility of humanity in the last phrase, our Bartleby, our humanity. It seems to me a very important matter has to do with, like, okay, what sustains life exactly? What? What makes you say, yes, I'll go on, or no, I won't? That is a real, like, a basic question. You're not thinking in the story at the end, John.
I think everything you've said would be illuminated by a suggestion that one of the things that gives Bartleby a poignancy and a dimension for Melville is this thinking about this as an exploration by Melville of a temptation and a danger of a possible response of his own, with his own lack of public communication and the lack of response to his books, and it's a very profound sort of exploration of what could happen if he let himself go that way and just withdrew and stopped writing.
Yeah, I think the energy from any writer comes from that kind of thing, absolutely. But I do think that Melville wants something bigger than that.
I think
he wants very much to make quite certain that the accurate questions are asked about, okay, why go on at all? Where is the impulse in human energy to go on developing? And what kind of situations are there where a man says no? And then starts to reduce the space and time of himself in his life, you know, to the point where it's sterile. I think this has a much wider reference than a neglected writer. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just suggest a sort of motivation that leads him to explore it as completely as it does.
Where he gets the energy from to do it. I agree with you. Okay, anybody? Now, next week, then, we look at those Emerson essays. I've got the list somewhere, haven't I? Yes, The American Scholar and Nature. Now, this is the philosophical figure behind the transcendentalist movement, Latour and so on. We can look at him next. Okay? Thank you.